Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2009, today's guest, journalist Jeff Charlotte, wrote an explosive book called The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. The Family, also known as The Fellowship, is an elite organization of white evangelical Christian men who all shared something in common, a hunger for political power, despite their political affiliation. The book revealed that the group recruited white male members over decades and gained the support and following of hundreds, if not thousands, of politicians. It operated in near secrecy under the philosophy that politicians were chosen to lead by God. The Fellowship has ties to world leaders, business people, and politicians, and its power is vast. In 2008, Jeff Charlotte wrote a follow-up called C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. His work has been turned into a 5-part docuseries for Netflix. It is streaming now. It's called The Family, and here is the trailer.
In my 20s, I stumbled my way in, and what I found is a secretive Christian organization called The Family that had been hiding in plain sight for over 80 years.
This was a group with tentacles around the world.
A humble example of leadership that the world has never seen.
A breathtaking enmeshment of church and state.
There were congressmen, senators, world leaders.
And they say it's about faith. But there's a shared understanding that what we're really about here is power.
I'd like to single out Doug Coe.
Doug Coe and all of his associates, I'm grateful.
Doug Coe is the longtime leader of the family.
He's the most powerful man in Washington you've never heard of.
He said the more invisible you can make your organization, the more influence it will have.
Jesus plus nothing. It's a powerful thing.
Using the National Prayer Breakfast, they dispatch representatives to build relationships with foreign leaders.
That is exactly the kind of meeting that I would want to exploit.
For the family, Jesus says you must go to those who are in positions of power.
God always uses imperfect vessels to do his perfect work. President Trump's an imperfect vessel.
Jesus is the answer, but Jesus and Capitol Hill don't mix.
Because we want our family to stay together.
A number of times after you first wrote The Family in 2009 and then your follow-up book called C Street. And, you know, I was pleasantly surprised to learn that your work has been turned into a Netflix docuseries. How did you connect with Netflix on this project?
Netflix sought it out. And I think I have to say I was pretty skeptical at first. I was like, this is a really complicated story. It's a story that you can tell in book form, but you have a problem when you have an organization that goes around, well, doesn't go around, but privately boasts about how invisible it is. The more invisible you can make your organization, we hear Doug Coe saying, the longtime leader saying, the more influence it'll have. So how are you going to make this, you know, how can we put this series on film? And they persuaded me. They teamed up with a terrific company called Jigsaw. Won an Oscar for its documentary on rendition, illegal rendition, Taxi to the Dark Side. Alex Gibney is the head of that company, and they found a terrific director, Jesse Moss. And they saw a way of not just telling the story that I told, but what was really important to us was to bring it to the present. You know, I published C Street in 2010. Well, where is the family now in the age of Trump? Mm. And does looking at the family help us understand why the Christian right has embraced this least pious of politicians more fervently than any other president in U.S. history?
Well, in the series, you say that Donald Trump is what the family's been waiting for. He is God's man.
He really is. And I remember actually, you know, there's a little bit of sort of I told you so-ism that lingers on in journalism of those journalists who thought Trump would be a contender right from the beginning. And I remember having a meeting with one of my editors and not long after Trump announced. And I said, look, take this guy seriously, because there's going to be a convergence of both the populist right and the elite right. The business right wing is going to like what he'll do for them, and the populists are going to love him. And one thing I did wonder is, could the family embrace him? And the reason I said that he's sort of what they were waiting for is because he's the kind of figure that they've supported around the world. They have a theology, a system of belief, where they speak of a figure, this is their language, called the Wolf King. And the Wolf King, they say, look, everyone else talks about Jesus going to the sheep. What about the wolves? Who's taking care of the wolves? And they say, we are. And not just any wolf, the leader of the pack, they call this figure the Wolf King. If you can go to the Wolf King, this holder of worldly power, and you can say, I'll bring to you this divine power of Jesus, then you can cut a deal. You can make a deal. And this idea of what Jesus is and what Jesus offers is modeled on yet another metaphor they have, and we hear it in the series. Doug Coe, if listeners are saying, well, isn't Jesus this nice guy, long hair and sandals? That's not how they think of him. Doug Coe, the longtime leader, says the way to understand Jesus is to look at figures such as, I'm quoting here, Hitler, Lenin, Mao. Now, there's an ideological spread there. He's not a fascist. He's not a communist. The common denominator is absolute strength. That's what they admire, and that's what they can work with. So Trump comes along and is that figure who they call in the series, because we got a lot of them to sit for the first time on camera. They call him the imperfect vessel, vessel chosen by God. He is the Wolf King, the kind of leader that they've raised up around the world, finally come home to the center of their power in the United States.
I mean, this is really fascinating and frightening. Evangelicals voted for Trump in higher percentages than any president in history. And in the docuseries, you point out that Trump actually preferred Chris Christie, but Mike Pence was really the deal because Christian conservatives love him. So when Trump chose Mike Pence, that sent a very strong message. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'm very proud of this one because I'm not in the business of making political predictions, but I did make one in my 2010 book, C Street, which I ended by saying, you know, the family's presidential prospects, two men who we see in the series, then Senator John Ensign and then Governor Mark Sanford, both of whom were felled by extramarital affairs, which the family then attempted to cover up. So those guys aren't going to the White House. Who will it be? In 2016, I said, maybe it'll be a little-known Indiana congressman named Mike Pence. So in 2010, I came very close to getting it right. I was one spot off. But yeah, I think what people didn't understand about Trump and Pence is sort of the naked transactionalism of it on both sides. No one is surprised by the idea of Trump as a cynical guy making a deal with a Christian right. But there's a way in which secular folks and liberal folks sometimes underestimate the Christian right. And when we cry hypocrisy, it's as if we think that they don't also live in a political world where they know they have to make deals to get the power that they want. They know that Pence is the deal. Trump knows that Pence is the deal. And with Pence came Betsy DeVos. At the Department of Education came Ben Carson. At HUD came Jeff Sessions, longtime member of the family. Came Sam Brownback of Kansas, longtime member of the family, now in the Trump administration. Sonny Perdue. I mean, a whole range of figures, many of them from the family, even more from the Christian right. And you go down one tier of government to the middle level, and you see the most fundamentalist administration in U.S. history. And I don't mean recent U.S. history. I mean the entirety of it. That's the great irony of the most impious president, is he has assembled the most devout, darkly devout administration we've ever had.
As you said, Jeff, your team got former members of the family to talk about their experiences and some of these scandals in public for the first time. You worked with the director, Jesse Moss. How did this team get these people to talk on camera?
Well, first of all, I just want to give credit where credit's due. I wouldn't want to call it my team. It's Jesse Moss's team. He's an amazing director. And in fact, it was his involvement that persuaded me that this was a good idea to go forward with. And that was really, I think... a result of a couple things. In 2017, the longtime leader of the family, who had been known as our sort of first brother, closer than anyone else in the family to God, to Jesus. He died in 2017, and Doug Coe's great ability was to not need publicity. He understood that invisibility gave you more influence. He didn't need the limelight. He didn't need to be the big man in the room. His successors, some of the people that we see sitting on camera, former Congressman Zach Womp, Doug Burley, these are men with a different kind of ego. They are used to being listened to, and they want credit for their work. So there's a little bit of that transformation in the family going on right now. There's also, I think it's fair to say, with the ascendancy of Trump, it's okay to be more out in the open. There's not really much of a, from their perspective, of a strong opposition to their vision for a God-led nation. But really the way that Jesse Moss and the team making this documentary did it was to go to these guys. They knew the series was going to be made. And I think they made the calculation that if they just came out and gave their side, that people would be persuaded. And really, we're fine with that. We gave them all the screen time they wanted. They're not happy with the series, but I don't think they can fairly complain. There's about a dozen of them speaking on camera, mm-hmm. and we would have happily given them more time to share their side of the story, to explain why secrecy is good for democracy, to explain why just asking everyone to follow Jesus is somehow not imposing Christianity. Go ahead. Tell us more, fellas.
Today we're talking about the new Netflix docuseries called The Family. It's available for streaming now, and it's based on Jeff Charlotte's best-selling 2009 book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. So, Jeff, for people who aren't familiar with The Family, you have such a fascinating history with this group, because when you were in your 20s, you started writing about religion, and you learned about this group through a friend whose mom and dad, actual family, was concerned that he joined a cult. And you had to be recommended to join the group. So through your friend you joined, you applied and you got accepted. And you were welcome to live there and be, a quote, a brother, as they put it. So you were taken to Arlington, Virginia. This is a suburb of D.C. where a lot of intelligence people live. And you moved into a house called Ivanwald. It's kind of like a frat house, but as you point out, no alcohol, drugs, swearing, or sex, no media. And basically, you're there to pray and learn how to obey. So can you just give us a quick synopsis of what really stood out for you during your experience at Ivanwald?
Yeah, we decided to open the series with a dramatization of that, partly because we wanted viewers to understand I think there's something creepy about it, but there's also something attractive. Part of what stood out to me was a lot of these young Christian conservative men, mostly white Americans, but also elites from around the world who had come to sort of apprentice themselves to this. And these were guys who were not necessarily comfortable with intimacy with other men. And here they were, spending time trying to listen to one another, trying to be brothers to one another. And there was something very strangely moving about it, and yet also something heartbreaking, because it took place in this context of breaking, of submission, of nothing, and yet also of the most grotesque kind of entitlement possible. We show, we dramatize one scene from that when David Coe, longtime leader of the family, comes and gives a sort of a biblical lesson to the young men. He says, you guys are here to rule the world. Learn how to rule the world. That's really what the idea is. And he talks about King David and how King David, even when he did terrible things, was still chosen by God. And then to bring the point home, he says, and I'll never forget this, I actually wrote it down in my Bible at the time. That's where I took my notes. And I should say, by the way, I published two books and now a series. The family's never disputed the facts of any of my reporting. They just don't like that I talk about it. What David Coe said, he said to one young guy, he says, suppose I heard you raped three little girls. What would I think of you? And this young guy, being a human being, says, you would think I'm terrible. And David sort of smiles and he says, no, not at all. Because you're chosen. That's what it means to be chosen by God. And so that was what sort of really struck me. And then, of course, also the presence of politicians. I prayed with Ed Meese, Reagan's attorney general. I missed by a few days a visit by Laura Bush. I was there when the then right-wing prime minister of Norway stopped by. Prominent figures in media, like the right-wing columnist Cal Thomas, who we see in the series speaking on behalf of the family, came by to give us a lesson on slavery. And his lesson was that without Jesus, if you weren't a follower of Jesus, there was no reason not to keep slaves. That is what stood out and scared me and compelled me to keep looking to try and understand how this thing had come about.
Jeff, I was actually going to ask you about that scene in which Co asks the young men, "What if you raped three little girls?" That was really shocking and telling. And so in the series, you say basically what he's saying is if you're chosen, it does not matter what you do. We will still be with you. It is all about being chosen. And I think for those of us who poo-poo maybe evangelicals or don't take them seriously, I think this is a really important issue to look at, because in this series, we also learn that the group of men believe that they're the most important people. In one scene, one of the young men, in fact, your friend, his girlfriend told him that she was sexually assaulted, and so he wanted to leave to be with her. And the brothers said, "No, you know, we're the most important ones in your life. You're chosen." So can you elaborate on that a bit? I think this is a really important part of the series.
Yeah, and I would say first that, you know, I don't dismiss evangelicals at all. In fact, one of the powerful voices of dissent we hear in the series is two, I think, that really stand out. Both very conservative Christians, Doug Hampton, a former member and chief of staff to Senator Ensign, is a powerful critic now, and Warren Throckmorton, also conservative Christian, speaking out because this is not what they mean when they say Christ. They don't think of someone who forgiveness for them is not the same as forgetting. The family actually has a sermon that says forgiveness is forgetting. And it was delivered in the context of the Filipino dictator Ferdinand Marcos. Let's not concentrate on the dead, on the body count. Forgive and forget. And that idea that's so central, and I'm glad you brought up what happened to the man, his only name we changed in the series, Luke, whose fiance was sexually assaulted, and they actually the men suggest that she brought this on herself. She was a Jezebel. That's something you encounter again and again. Other, by the way, Christian conservatives who stood up to them. There's a hard Christian right magazine called World Magazine. They are fundamentalists, but they do not like it when you compare Jesus to Hitler. And so they went and did some good investigative reporting, had access to some people I don't have access to, the wives of some of these conservative congressmen who were very candid and said, you know, in my husband's life, his brothers and the family come before me and our children. You see that same story in former Governor Mark Sanford, governor of South Carolina, who was famous for having an affair but telling the world he was hiking the Appalachian Trail. And his wife, Jenny Sanford, after he was discovered, he outsourced the management of his marriage to the family and told his wife, Jenny, that she was to take all her issues, not to him, but to another man in the family. She calls him Jack. And she says that the family told her she should not burden her husband with tears or complaints. Her job as a wife was to wait for his return because despite his sins, and they don't deny their sins, he was chosen by God. That's one thing with an extramarital affair. It's quite another when you look at some of their foreign clients that we show in the series. Sani Abacha, General Sani Abacha, the dictator of Nigeria. And there's some graphic, horrifying scenes. David Bahati in Uganda, the author of the Kill the Gays Bill, a genocidal initiative. The list goes on. They don't say it's right that these people do these violent things. It's more that they say it's not what is most important. What is most important, they believe, is power.
We'll talk about the work of the family overseas, but I first wanted to ask you another question about their views on women. Because at the mansion, the Cedars Mansion, politicians got together there to chat, to pray, to have breakfast. And in the docuseries, this is the first time that we actually see a woman. There's a young woman in the room, and she is serving breakfast to the young brothers and then the politicians. And some of these women, as you point out, were really young. Some were in their mid-20s. You said that it was the most gender-segregated world you'd ever lived in. The women were being mentored in service and directed toward relationships with the men of the fellowship, whereas the men were being mentored to possibly one day be in positions of power.
Yeah, in fact, I just 2 days ago got some correspondence from a former member, a woman who described just that. She had been a resident at one of their houses for young women. There's more than one. There's houses such as this in their operations around the globe, but this is the one in Arlington at the headquarters. It's called Potomac Point, and it's right across from their mansion. And she said she was so stunned. She was, you know, somewhat Christian conservative, but she had a sense of herself and her, you know, her worth and so on. And she got there and she saw the young men, as I was at that time. I was invited to sit at the lunch or the breakfast with several ambassadors, a senator, Ed Meese. She was invited to serve us. At first, she thought it was just a one-time thing that we were going to be rotating. Women are there to serve. The family, the inner circle, and not every member. This is not a rigid organization. It's part of how they endure. But the inner circle embraces an idea called male headship. Male headship. I mean, it sounds like a gross pun or something. But what it is the idea that as Christ is to the church, so a man is to the women and his family, that the role of women is to listen and obey. Now, there can be powerful women, and there have, in fact, been women in leadership roles, but not many. And, you know, you said that was the first woman we see in the series. And, in fact, one left critic said, how come we're not hearing more women's voices from the family? And the answer is because they're not allowed to speak. We would have been happy to put them on film. But in fact, we do see in the series some of the family's neighbors, just women who live in that neighborhood who became quite concerned by this really troubling organization in their little Arlington suburb. And they went and wanted to meet with them, you know, neighborhood association kind of thing, and were told that they could not meet with the leadership of the family alone, that they had to bring their husbands. Because like Mike Pence, who won't be in a room with a woman alone without his wife, whom he calls mother, they needed the permission of their husbands to really have a voice in the family.
Jeff, you had this firsthand experience with the family living there 20 years ago. Are they still recruiting young men and women today?
Yeah, Ivan Walden Durs. There's another house on Capitol Hill called Jonathan House. There are, in fact, I just heard about a new house they're building for a sort of a businessman's retreat and an accompanying house for younger men who will be apprenticed, as I was in Georgia. There's residences in Denver. There's real estate in Moscow. This is a very ongoing work. You know, the one thing I've been hearing since the series from former members is that the C Street scandals, the scandals of how they used their C Street house for congressmen, where they were getting the taxpayers to subsidize rent, because they had registered this house, this frat house for Jesus, as a church. The scandals of how they used that to cover up extramarital affairs, that did hurt them. And they have sort of shifted. We see them, you know, until that point, they just denied that they existed. I don't mind bragging. I mean, because they themselves said it. Bob Hunter, who we see in the series, went on TV and acknowledged we have been too secretive. And we're coming out now because of Charlotte's book. that's how reporting's supposed to work. It wasn't just mine. It was Lisa Getter at the LA Times. It was reporters at the AP. It was Christian Wright reporters at World Magazine. It was local reporters who were holding their congresspeople accountable. So there's that. On the other hand, yeah, there's a sense in which they're actually growing now. This is a right-wing moment, not just in the United States, but globally. Almost across the board.
So these houses still exist. They're still recruiting young people. Do you have any idea what, if anything, has changed since you lived there?
Interestingly, actually, that a terrific reporter for the Washington Post dug in actually for a while, named Annie Gowan, dug in on that house that I was in, Ivanwald, and. You saw, when I was there, you saw sometimes young guys, guys from prominent families. I remember there was one guy from Oklahoma, and his parents were friends with Congressman Steve Largent. And he'd gone to college and maybe gotten lost his way with some drugs and so on. So they sent him there. Now, he wasn't an addict. He was just a guy messing around. But they sent him there to straighten him out. But others were going there who really did need treatment and were going there. The treatment was Jesus in service to politicians. What's interesting is I'm told by some more recent former members that they've actually, at that particular residence, increased that. There's more and more people that they are using this idea that we're going to cure you of dependency. Now, that sounds great, right? Any way you can get it, you can cure your addiction. On the other hand, you have to look at the way the family works. I think of the example of Senator Jim DeMint, South Carolina, former senator. He then went on to be head of the Right Wing Heritage Foundation. And he described, he moved into their house on C Street, and he described how amazed he was. After a lifetime as a conservative Christian, he had gone in this small group of men, and instead of really talking about the Bible, they were just to disclose to one another the most horrendous things they had ever done. And, you know, this is cult 101, right? This is the way in which you go to powerful people. You make a safe space for the powerful. You let them disclose their secrets, and now you've got their secrets. You carry their secrets for them. And I think that's become more of a focus. And the other area where they've reached into more, they've always been involved with business, but they have been, apparently in recent years, emphasizing even more their outreach to elite businessmen.
We're going to take a quick break. Today on Your Call, we are talking about the new docuseries from Netflix called The Family. It is available for streaming now, and it's based on Jeff Charlotte's best-selling book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. And it exposes how an elite organization of white evangelical Christian men, mostly politicians, are shaping policies here in the United States and around the globe. And we will talk more just about what this group has been doing in many, many countries around the world. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 8255 toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Joshua Johnson's guest will be Democratic presidential candidate and Montana Governor Steve Bullock on 1A, 11 o'clock, 1/2 hour from now here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about voter security in 2020. Many states are planning to increase voter security by finally going back to paper ballots. A number of people in the security community have said, forget the machines. because they're not secure. We need to go back to paper ballots. So we will be talking about that tomorrow. If you have a show idea, a guest idea, or feedback, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast, you can also find that information at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about a new docuseries from Netflix. It's available for streaming now. It's called The Family, and it's based on the best-selling book by Jeff Charlotte, also called The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Jeff is an award-winning journalist and associate professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College. And if you have any questions or comments for Jeff about his reporting on this group, what he learned about them in his early 20s and where they are today, we'd love to hear from you. And I just find their relationship with Trump is just fascinating. Basically, Jeff says the family has been waiting for Trump. He is God's man. Evangelicals voted for him in higher percentages than any president in history. So if you have any questions about that, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Jeff, we have an email from Diane, and she says, what are the criteria they use to decide who is chosen?
Power. They say we work with power where we can, build new power where we can't. And they really are, and this is what sort of distinguishes them from the public Christian right, and even makes some members of the sort of the regular fundamentalism distrust them. They're willing to work with anybody. They don't care. They like to say, look, we're not Christian. We are willing to help anybody, Jew, Muslim, Hindu. We'll help anybody submit to Jesus. I mean, this is kind of strange rhetoric. Congressman Zach Womp actually just told his local paper, this is, you know, are you involved in this kind of thing? He says, oh, no, it's not a Christian, stealth Christian thing. We bring Jesus to everybody, and they will. They work with those whom they call messianic Muslims. They work with Jews for Jesus. They work with even liberals if they're willing to work with them. And what matters most is power. And if you're in power and you're willing to work with them, they will work with you. And if you're not, that's the second part of their that slogan of theirs. We work with power where we can, build new power where we cannot.
Have any Democrats done work for the family overseas, or is it mostly Republicans?
Yeah, Democrats have done work for the family overseas. Although the Democratic involvement tends to be more domestic, like former Democratic Congressman Bart Stupak, a resident of their C Street house, teamed up with right-wing Republican Congressman, former Congressman Joe Pitts, this was in 2010, I think, to introduce and pass something called the Stupak-Pitts Amendment. And there are many turning points where we can look at and say, how do we get to this point where Roe v. Wade is so reproductive rights are so on the brink, so threatened? But I think you can make a strong case of Stupak-Pitts as a real pivot point and a collaboration between a Democrat and a Republican that had long been in the works and was entirely through the family. Other congressmen, Democrats, go overseas. And I asked, there's a man in the series we see named Bob Hunter, described himself as a liberal, an unusual kind of liberal, but that's his term for himself. And I asked him, I said, when you use Democrats or politicians, when you bring these politicians, American politicians, overseas to these countries, why are you bringing these people, especially people who we might not really associate with, you know, the Christian right? And he was so candid in his answer. I'm just going to quote it. He said, and I quote, they're bait. So you see Democrats who sometimes don't really bother to dig in. They have egos too, and they're willing to sort of travel on the family's dime. And they end up functioning as recruiting devices. We see Senator Chris Coons in the series and of Delaware, who's been very involved. And you just want to say you have a responsibility to ask more questions. Now, some of them, I remember interviewing now he's out of office, but Senator Mark Pryor, Democrat from Arkansas, you know, an anti-choice, pro-war, anti-labor, free market Democrat. But he was a Democrat. A Democrat who, by the way, told me that he had learned from the family that separation of church and state was a myth. And that, in fact, the United States really is a Christian nation. That guy is going to make a pretty good emissary for them overseas.
Diane, second question is, when they choose young men for their residences, how do they choose them?
You get recommended. It's pretty free form, you know. I mean, I mentioned the young man who was recommended by Congressman Steve Largent. When I was living in the House, there was another young guy from Australia who had been sent by a right-wing Australian politician named Bruce Baird. There was a young right-wing aspiring Norwegian politician who had been sent by some right-wing politicians who we actually see on camera and the series. As I say, I was recommended by a brother. You know, there's this idea that, look, if somehow you come into their circle, well, it must be God's hand. And occasionally there would be flukes. I remember there was one young man who came, and he thought this was great. He would stay at Ivanwald while he went to protests in Washington, left-wing protests. And, you know, he was a Christian. He was a leftist Christian. And, you know, they didn't say, get out. They just quietly suggested, uh-huh, this may not be the place for you. And he figured it out and moved on.
Well, thank you for the emails, Diane. And if you have any questions for Jeff Charlotte, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org, or you can call us 866-798-8255. And we're talking about the new Netflix docuseries, The Family. Jeff, let's talk about what The Family is doing overseas. I thought this was one of the more fascinating parts of the series. As you report in the series, the family cannot think of a dictator they wouldn't meet with. They build tremendous access to nearly every government on earth. And it was so interesting to learn about Robert Aderholt, a fiercely conservative representative from Alabama. He is not a big name in U.S. politics. I have to say I've never heard of the guy, but I did some reading about him after learning about him in the family. And he travels to Romania on a trip paid for by the family. He's also traveled to Albania and Montenegro. And as you say, people like Aderholt, they're going to places where not many people are paying attention to, realizing they can have a huge influence. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I think most Americans don't understand that we're so conditioned by the sort of the know-it-allness of cable news, where they'll refer to some lesser-known politician. He's a nobody. Well, if you're a member of, you know, one of the most selective clubs in the world, the U.S. Congress, and you go to a country like Romania or Uganda or Sri Lanka, countries for which U.S. aid and U.S. military aid are essential to those in power, you are a big man, and Aderholt loves this. Aderholt is able to sort of heft his weight. It's been interesting watching the reception to the Netflix series, because the Netflix series is global. So I've been trying to use Google Translate to read the Romanian press, because they know who Aderholt is.
Wow.
The series about Aderholt, who came and campaigned for anti-LGBT politics on the family's dime as a representative of U.S. power. Well, we also see in the series Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, probably the most right-wing senator, who is one of the few guys who's really open about it. He brags about it, how he uses taxpayer money and military transport, hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe more than that by now, to travel all over Africa. I think he's traveled more in Africa than any member of Congress. And what is he doing? He's representing two interests, Jesus and oil. Those are his great concerns. And that is what and he's upfront. He says, I go and I talk about my Jesus thing. And he's pretty upfront about how he also talks about his oil thing. And so he uses taxpayer money to travel and combined with family money. I mean, I can't think of a clearer example of the failure of church-state separation when you have this synergy of private public money sending out American power carrying the cross.
So first let's talk about Aderholt and what he did in Romania, and then we'll talk about Inhofe and what he did in Uganda. So Aderholt has been a congressman since 1997, a representative from Alabama's 4th Congressional District. And you have a clip of Aderholt giving an interview to a Romanian media outlet talking about, you know, the importance of family and marriage between a man and a woman. And as you said, in Romania, conservative groups wanted to change the constitution to read that marriage is between a man and a woman. So basically, some of these guys realized that, well, gay marriage is now legal in the United States, so we've got to go overseas to spread this dangerous message. And I just want to play a clip. This is from the family, and we're going to hear from Vlad Visky, who's executive director of Mosaic. It's M-O-Z-A-I-Q. It's an LGBTQI organization in Romania. We will also hear from a member of the group.
In issues concerning gay rights, concerning abortion rights, in Eastern Europe, what we've seen is a stronger and stronger involvement of the American religious right into internal politics. In the U.S., we see that 60% of people support gay marriages. So in the U.S., the battle against gay marriage is a lost one. Therefore, they move forward to other countries where they can influence policies and politics. They find fertile ground for their ideology and create these networks with indigenous conservative movements.
They have a purpose now in their life, to hate you as LGBT. And it's sad.
And that is a clip from The Family. Today we're talking with Jeff Charlotte, whose book is also called The Family, a bestseller that came out in 2009. So can you talk more about this, Jeff? They couldn't stop gay marriage in the U.S., but maybe they can stop it in other countries.
Yeah, I mean, and that actually is a conservative evangelical strategy that goes back to the very first Great Awakening in the United States, before the United States, when Jonathan Edwards, that figure from you might remember from your high school education, who said sinners in the hands of an angry God, he couldn't get the colonists to go to church. So what did he do? He went and participated in the forcible conversion of Native Americans. And they were props, so that you could go back and you say, look at these savages. These savages worship God. Why don't you? It's a sort of an encirclement strategy, and it's always been the way. And internally, the family's pretty open about it. You can pass policies in Romania or these other small countries that you might not in the United States. But that example of Aderholt, who's a really fascinating character, who's one of his big financial backers, is a longtime board member of the family named Ronnie Cameron, major Trump donor, and they have a deep relationship. Aderholt has played an important role in the Agricultural Committee. Cameron is a big money guy and something, I kid you not, called Big Chicken. That is the group of the poultry industry, which that touches on immigration, that touches on environment and so on. So, but they also have these conservative social values, and they go over to Romania. Now, the reason we included that story in episode 4 of the Netflix series, one, it was happening in real time. We were watching it, and we could see what was happening. We could see Aderholt traveling, and we could also see the resistance. That this wonderful man you just heard speaking, who says it so clearly. We didn't want our series for those of us who believe in transparent democracy to be without hope. And in Romania, there's a victory. Mm-hmm. They organize. They push back against Aderholt's influence. They don't do it with big money. They do it with lots of people. They do it with democracy. And they were able, for now, to stop that in Romania, even as the anti-LGBT crusade, the gender nationalism of Christian nationalism, grows stronger and stronger in so many other countries.
Yeah. We also learned that over the last 16 years, Representative Aderholt has traveled to 18 countries on behalf mm-hmm. of the family, including Austria, Bolivia, Colombia, Sudan, and Jordan. Jeff, I mean, this is... Why don't we hear more about this? This guy is going overseas as a representative of the U.S. government, pushing anti-gay, anti-abortion, other pieces of legislation. Why don't we hear more about this? And in fact, I have to say, I read a number of reviews about the family, and I hardly saw any mention of the work that Adderholt's doing overseas in these reviews.
I mean, that's the arrogance of American power, and it inflicts the center and even many liberals as well. We assume it's our right to go and tell other countries what to do. But there's a sense in which we do hear about it. I would love to claim that I'm the first reporter to uncover this story, but you go back through history. I mean, the first expose I could find was 1959. 1959, the Washington Post says, international travel. Department of Defense was providing military transport and funding for a group of four congressmen to travel to family meetings throughout Europe. And the Washington Post said, this is flagrantly First Amendment violation. And it's worse than that because it means that they are doing sort of off-the-books diplomacy that don't necessarily represent the interests of the United States. But there wasn't much of a follow-up, and that becomes a pattern. 1960s, New Republic reports on off-the-books lobbying at the National Prayer Breakfast. No follow-up. Dan Rather in the aftermath of Watergate says, what's going on here with, Chuck Colson, who would go to prison for his role in Watergate, even after he was, gone and indicted, was still showing up at the White House. And the press secretary says he's there for prayer meetings. And Dan Rather says everyone knows prayer meetings in the White House are used for politics, as indeed Chuck Colson would later brag they were. Mid-1970s, Playboy magazine, Robert Scheer, great investigative reporter, does a massive investigation showing that the family is operating as an off-the-books bank, which is to say an illegal bank for congressmen. Where's the follow-up? There's no follow-up. And on it goes. And we see in the Netflix series a terrific reporter, Lisa Getter, talking about this. And, there's been this reporting and, people sort of want to say, is there some kind of conspiracy? Sometimes you get someone like Ronald Reagan, who Ronald Reagan actually, in 1985, at the prayer breakfast, the family, sometimes known as a fellowship, he says, there's fellowship groups operating all over the place. He says, but, and you can see video of him saying this, he says, I don't always get along with the press, but this day I commend them for their restraint in helping this work stay off the record. It wasn't any kind of conspiracy. It's a much worse, damning, more horrible power in the American press and American politics is conventional wisdom. The family doesn't look like fundamentalists are supposed to look. They're not sweaty pulpit pounders. They're not Jerry Falwell in a too tight suit, sort of spitting at a microphone and saying, the hand of God is removed. They don't speak with a Southern accent. And so we don't see them. And it's true. You've seen it even in some responses to the current Netflix series. We're overseas. It's interesting. Overseas, the press has been really pretty good.
Wow.
Here we see even people who style themselves liberals saying, I don't get it. What's the big deal? It's just a group of men who want to get together privately think about Jesus and how to run government on his principles. What's the problem?
Right. Well, Jeff, we're almost
out of
time.
And so democracy falls.
I wish we had some more time, but I think this clip, hopefully we'll have time for it. But it tells you a lot about what goes on behind the scenes. So James Inhofe, a Republican from Oklahoma, travels to Nigeria to meet with General Sone Abosu, the dictator of Nigeria. He's killed some of his own citizens. And in this clip, you'll hear from Senator Inhofe, Jeff, our today's guest, Jeff Charlotte, and Marcus Owen, a partner with Loeb & Loeb. Here's a clip from The Family.
He started talking about political things. And so after a little while, I said, well, Mr. President, really, yeah, I'm a member of the United States Senate, but I didn't come over here as a senator. In fact, I came all the way across the Atlantic and down to Sub-Saharan Africa to tell you that in the spirit of Jesus, we love you. That probably the first time this man has ever cried, at least in front of people, when we prayed together.
Bob just sends all his aides out of the room. So now here we have this access. This is what we have built this veritable underground of men in government for. What do they say? They say, brother, I love you. That's all. Not brother, I love you. And let us talk about what love means. And let us talk about murder. About killing your own citizens. That's not what happens. Instead, what's he saying it's all about? Jesus. And what do you know? The dictator says, yeah, sure. Jesus. Jesus? Jesus. Jesus, Jesus. And the money flows. And the guns flow. And the oil flows. There are all these ways that these figures, in return for their deference, their subservience, their recognition of the natural order of God, are rewarded.
From my perspective, the difficulties with the Fellowship Foundation go to the involvement in Africa, paying travel expenses of members of Congress. There was always a veil behind the sources of money.
There's a budget, fairly large budget, many millions of dollars. There's a staff, too. But you might look at the records, and one year their salary is this, and the next year their salary is zero, and yet all the time they're flying around in private jets. This is what they call the man method.
And that is a clip from The Family. Jeff, we're almost out of time, but I really wanted to play that clip because it gives us a sense of what goes on behind the scenes when the United States makes a decision, for example, to sell weapons to a dictator like Sone Obosu in Nigeria.
It really does. It really does. And you see that convergence. You know, there's a sense in which people listening to this story or watching the Netflix series might say, I don't get it. You know, is this just astonishing naivete? And that's what some defenders or partial defenders want to say. Or is this cynicism? And I think the answer of The Family and the secret to their power is it's both at the same time.
And in the coming years, do you expect them to be as strong and influential?
Right now, Mike Pence, and there's a deep, deep bench of figures behind him. Senator John Thune, probably a future presidential prospect in his own mind, at least, from South Dakota. A number of other figures, rising stars. There's no reason there shouldn't be, except, I suppose, the kind of sunlight that you and I and everyday people can bring by holding our representatives accountable.
Jeff Charlotte is Associate Professor of English and Creative Writing at Dartmouth College and author of the 2009 book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. It has been turned into a 5-part Netflix docuseries called The Family. It is streaming now. Jeff, thank you so much for your work. It's great to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.